Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. On our program this morning, we'll be talking with George Gale, professor of philosophy at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and our topic is the birth of modern science. George, glad to have you on the show.
Glad to be here, Hugh.
All right. The aim is to talk about the birth of modern science. It might be helpful, though, to do a little bit of history to set the stage for it. A little discussion about the precursors to modern science. When we talk about the ancients' view of the nature of the world, I mean, could you give some kind of brief description which can sort of set the stage of where we're going to go?
The wonderful thing about the views of the world that the Greeks and the Romans had is that they're just incredibly diverse. I guess you've got three basic streams going. One is the kind of stream of Platonism that ends up impacting upon the Christian religion very, very heavily. And it's a sort of a spiritualist way of looking at things, and you see later on with Augustine and so on. Now, this doesn't have a terrible lot of influence early on in science, although it does later. The other two streams that are remarkably influential in the ancient world and then ended up cropping back up in the modern world are the views of the, I guess you could call them, the physicalists, the people like Democritus, who was an atomist, and Empedocles, who was a rootist, a radicalist, I suppose. The two of them believe that the world could be conceived in terms of material substances. The atomists believe that material substances were spread out in chunks. Just the world is made up of discrete particles of all sorts of shapes. And that when you broke anything down, whether it was water or olive oil or wine, when you broke it down into its ultimate constituents, it was in these little chunks called atoms. Empedocles and the others were not physicists in the same way. They were more chemists. They believed that the way you looked at the world was in terms of the elements, of its elementary constituents, not necessarily in terms of its particles. So they were more interested in this, and I guess we would have to say, although it's a little anachronistic to say it, but still I'm going to say it, in terms of the chemical constitution of things. And they spoke about the four elements, air, earth, fire, and water. So these are the physicalist views, and they contrast very, very straightforwardly with the spiritualist views coming out of the Platonic tradition. But the guy who really had the influence was Aristotle. And Aristotle was one of the brightest guys there ever was. And he was a biologist and a physician. And his view of the natural world is more based in his biological views than it is based in the kinds of physical views that Empedocles and Democritus had. And he looks upon most of the world not exactly as living, but as having certain sorts of dynamic behaviors that in some ways are similar to the way living beings work. So anyway, the stage is set for modern science in the 13th and 14th centuries by this wonderful soup of a collection of views coming from Plato, who by that time had really inspired the mathematicians, and Empedocles and Democritus, who would inspire the physicists, and the people thinking more along biological lines, and in some ways also in astronomy, the views coming out of Aristotle. So you had this wonderful soup of stuff just kind of preparing the way for what we now call the origins of modern science.
All right, now, one way then in which this earlier soup can be described is, or at least sometimes is described, is pre-scientific. Now, I don't know whether that terminology rankles you or whether you would agree with it. Well, I mean, do you agree with it? Would you consider them pre-scientific?
Yeah, certainly. Although if you get four philosophers of science and three scientists and put them in a room together, you'll get 15 different definitions of exactly what science is. Most all of us will agree that science, today's science, is measuring, theorizing, and hypothesizing kind of activity. It involves both the mind and the eye. And I use the eye to stand for all the senses in terms of observation and measuring. And the thing that's interesting about modern science is that it combines the senses and the brain in ways that didn't occur very frequently in the ancient world. There are some examples in the ancient world. For example, Archimedes' work with the five basic machines, five simple machines, and his work in statics and hydrodynamics, and that stuff is absolutely science. I mean, there's just no question about it. When Archimedes' stuff was found in late 16th, early 17th century, people were just astounded at how good this guy was. So I guess I'd have to say that with the exception of Archimedes and a few like him, most of the activity, most of the things that were going on in the classical world were pre-scientific, although they certainly, from time to time, espoused a kind of a scientific spirit about things. Sometimes Aristotle, you see the glimmers in Aristotle where he, if you push him a little bit, twist him a little, slant him a little bit this way or the other, you could get a rather more scientific view out of him.
All right, Nate, could you say a little bit more about what you mean by the scientific spirit? I mean, I'm assuming in part it's captured by those three terms you used earlier, measuring, theorizing, and hypothesizing. But maybe just say a bit more about that.
I guess ultimately the thing in modern science that we see is the realization of the need for a connection between what's going on in our brain, between the theorizing and what we can do with our senses in terms of what we can observe, what we can measure, what we can experiment with. Sometimes, for example, if you look at Aristotle, when he's talking about embryology, Aristotle's no slouch. When he's the guy who did the original chicken egg experiment, you know, maybe you did it in high school. I know they did it in our high school, where you take a chicken egg, a fertilized chicken egg, and you a bunch of them, and you open them up on every day of fertilization and watch the embryo, the chicken, develop. Well, Aristotle was there. He's the one who basically designed that experiment. So you see these glimpses of a science, what we would today call a scientific spirit, in the old classic thinkers, but it's not sustained. There's no self-conscious overarching model of what it is to be scientific, and that's why there doesn't seem to be any tradition in the olden times that kept everything going. And I mean, that, I suppose, is one way you can explain what happened in the Middle Ages, well, in the early Roman times, and on into the Middle Ages, when we didn't have any science, and that was that there hadn't been a strong tradition established earlier. It was something that needed to be put together in a sustained sort of fashion.
Okay, I want to come back to that later, so let me just toss it out. I mean, the terminology of tradition here might be interesting in giving your answers to think about why, in what ways tradition is important for the ongoing practice of science. But let me jump into the next question. If you're going to identify roughly the period in which modern science begins, when would it be, and would it be the same for all sciences?
That's a really good question. When I first got into this business, the history and philosophy of science business, the general impression was that it all began with Copernicus in the early 1540s, and then when it was culminated with Newton in 1686. But that view was a view, I think, that was naive in one sense and in another sense too professional. The most of the historians and philosophers of science, and when I got into the rackets in the late 60s, were people who had been trained in physics, and they tended to look upon the history of science as a historian of physics or philosopher of physics would. And so wherever they looked, they saw physics, and astronomy. But as other specialties in the history and philosophy of science have developed lately, and there's more professionalization and disciplinization within history and philosophy of science, it's begun to be clear that the different sciences evolved or came into existence, even at different modern sciences, at different times. And what I've tried to do in my own thinking is I've tried to pick out a seminal publication or a seminal event in the history of physics. Well, I do it actually, astronomy, physics, chemistry, and biology. And by looking at those dates, I can make a little more sense out of what one calls the origin of modern science. One thing, by the way, that's kind of interesting is one way to look at these different origins is to look at them as the day or the event that, in effect, in that science, threw off Aristotle, because Aristotle's views were so dominant in the beginning of the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries, among the people who later became the founders of the sciences, that when biology, for example, became a science, it became non-Aristotelian biology. That's what it was to become modern biology. And when chemistry became a modern science, it became so by throwing out the last vestiges of Aristotle's kinds of ways of looking at things in chemistry. Okay, now, bottom line. I think that astronomy was the very first of the modern sciences to get modern. And that's roughly with the period between Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo, which runs roughly 1540 to about 1630. By that point, most of what we think of as modern astronomy and the modern astronomical model of the solar system in particular was in place. Galileo's work doubled also into modern physics. And the central core of modern physics, well, central core of any kind of physics, even ancient physics, is the theory of motion. You've got to be able to describe how things change over time in terms of their locations in space. And that work, the theory of motion, which is it's basically the first chapter in any physics book, the first chapter in the physics books, modern physics books, was written between about 1615 with Galileo and 1686 with Newton, and that's when the first chapters then were written. It took 100 years to get chemistry going. Newton had some followers who tried to make Newtonian chemistry work, but they couldn't make it work. And chemistry basically came out of a different tradition than physics. It came out of Empedocles' tradition, and it came out of pharmacy and mineralogy and metallurgy, of all strange things we might think. And that was right around the time of the American Revolution with Lavoisier. And in fact, Lavoisier, the Frenchman, who I guess I'd have to say discovered or created or invented modern chemistry right around 1776, Lavoisier was such a good chemist that his assistant came over to the United States and took all the techniques he'd learned at making gunpowder that he learned under Lavoisier, and helped the American revolutionaries get started making their own gunpowder and not having to import it from France. And that was one of the reasons why our guns were so good, because we had Lavoisier's gunpowder. Hugh, do you know the name of that Lavoisier's assistant who came over?
No, I don't.
DuPont.
Ah.
DuPont was Lavoisier's assistant. He brought Lavoisier's new chemical methods over and made gunpowder in what's now Delaware. Then about another 100 years, in 1859, 1860, two things happened. One was the publication by Pasteur of reports on a set of experiments with fermentation, in which he showed that fermentation was not necessarily a chemical phenomenon, but in fact was a biological phenomenon. And fermentation is a really central reaction in biology, because it's also linked to disease and has been since the time of the ancients. And so when Pasteur got some good things understood about fermentation, he also had some things understood about disease. And so that really gave biology on its own a strong leg up against the chemical kinds of ideas which had been pervasive until then. The other big thing, of course, was Darwin. And what Darwin provided was a kind of an overarching theory into which the biological sciences could be rather neatly folded and laid out. So Darwin's theory provides in the biological sciences the same kind of framework that cosmology and deep space astronomy provides for all the physical sciences. It's, you know, it just gives puts everything in its place. I guess the last natural science that, and this, what I'm going to say, he was really controversial, and I'm sure you'll get calls from irate geologists, but I reckon that modern geology started in about 1960. When, for the first time, there was an overarching theory of the Earth, the theory of continental drift, and underlying it, the mathematical theory that spoke of the movements of solid plates upon a sphere. And once that was in place, the Earth sciences then were able to, it seems to me, get a proper layout with respect to one another, and so that in that sense, the theory of continental drift plays the same role in the Earth sciences that Darwin's theory does in biology, and that the Big Bang theory does in cosmology. So you get this nice kind of layout of disciplines and tasks and subjects and everything underneath these overarching theories. So there you got it. It's what, 1540. Roughly 1540 to 1960, that works out to about 420 years for the origin of modern science, at least as far as I kind of think of it.
Okay, actually, I want to talk about that too, how the reason took so long. But let's go back and talk about the very beginnings. I mean, you mentioned Copernicus. Even if Copernicus is not the father of modern science, that is all sciences.
Uh-huh.
Since you date astronomy as the first of the sciences to emerge, and you date Copernicus as being central to its birth, it seems to me a good place to begin. I mean, what is it that Copernicus did that was so important?
I lay it out the following way: the intellectual scene in the 1500s was really gorgeous. And now I'm speaking as somebody who's studied and taught way too much logic when I say that. But the intellectual scene was just gorgeous. The Aristotelian framework had been linked together in all of the sciences, in all of the humanities, in just about every aspect of the intellectual life. Aristotle's views or Aristotelian views or later developments out of Aristotelian views have been linked together to make this incredible, beautiful intellectual construct. I mean, the world was organized, the world of thought and the world of theory and the world of belief was made up of this incredibly beautiful structure of concepts and beliefs and their relevant attitudes. That we can't, it was so nicely woven and we can't even imagine what a beautiful fabric it was. But the problem with a fabric like that is that it is a fabric. And when you start a tear at one point in the fabric, you immediately begin to worry about losing the other parts of the fabric. And that, to me, is what Copernicus and his movement in astronomy represented. They represented the first tear in the fabric of the Aristotelian world view, the picture that you got out of the post-Aristotelian philosophy. Once he had shown that it was possible to give a reasonable and coherent picture in a small area, and that picture was opposed to Aristotle's view, then it was almost inevitable that in other areas people were going to try to see whether they could do the same anti-Aristotelian kind of thing. So what Copernicus did basically was not much if you look at it in absolute terms. What did Copernicus do? He said, well, if you take the Aristotelian view, the post-Aristotelian view, the Aristotelian traditional view that the earth is at the center of everything, and everything else, all the other heavenly bodies, circulate literally. In other words, they revolve in circles around the earth, and the earth is stationary at the center. If you do the simplest thing to that, namely exchange the places of the earth and the sun, then everything else in the system ends up having to change. And Copernicus showed that if you exchange the positions of the sun and the earth, it made more sense. Now, a lot of people said, well, what he did was he showed that you could get better predictions about astronomical events and you got a better calendar that way, but as a matter of fact, it wasn't any better. The reason that Copernicus's move worked was it's right in his preface. He says, look, if you exchange these two heavenly bodies, it makes a lot more sense. I mean, doesn't it make more sense, he said, to have the sun at the center? Because he said, after all, it is of much greater majesty than the earth. And he put the center there, he showed it could be done, that he could get a calendar and astronomical predictions at least as good as the Aristotelian view. And if that's the case, then why not give it a try? And that's precisely what he did. And once he'd done that, Kepler looked at it and said, gee, this is really interesting. His results are at least as good as Aristotle's, or as Ptolemy's, who's a later Aristotelian, and it makes more sense. Let me see if I can work with it. Kepler worked with it and discovered that the orbits weren't circular. And when I say discovered, I mean it took him 20 years, okay? It's not the kind of thing he looked up one day and said, oh, they're ellipses. I mean, it took him a lot of work. But he worked that out, and so what you then had by the time Kepler was finished is you had a system of heavenly bodies orbiting around the sun in elliptical paths. And at that point, because Kepler's work was much, much better than anything in the Aristotelian-Ptolemaic tradition as far as his predictions about astronomical events were concerned, you know, eclipses and that sort of thing, since his work was so much better, basically his ideas stuck. And at that point, there was a permanent hole in the Aristotelian fabric of the intellectual world picture.
All right, let me ask you, would it be fair to say, summarize it in this way, that what happened is Copernicus threw out an idea. He himself did not have a whole lot of empirical support for the idea at the moment, but he simply threw out an idea and suggested that it might be so. The idea itself had sufficient appeal that other people pursued it, and the work of Kepler and Tycho gave it the empirical teeth it needed. They gave it the evidence, the observations that it was needed to make Copernicus' suggestions highly plausible.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, Copernicus's data, his ability to make predictions about astronomical events, wasn't any better than the ancients. But by the time Kepler had worked it over, and you're right to mention Tycho Brahe, because Tycho Brahe was the greatest observational astronomer of the early modern period, and certainly the greatest naked. I mean, he didn't have any telescopes. He's making observations in 1565, 1575, and so on. And his observations, Tycho Brahe's observations, were just fantastic. They were really accurate. And Kepler went to work for him because apparently Tycho was a really hard guy to get along with. And Kepler went to work for him because Kepler was the greatest mathematician alive in those days, probably. And Kepler knew that in order to figure out whether Copernicus was right, he was going to need the empirical data, the astronomical observations that only Tycho had. So he went and he worked for Tycho up in Denmark in this horrible community that Tycho had organized. And he when Tycho died, he got out of there with the observations and ran back to Vienna. He was Kepler was the astronomer royal of the Habsburg, the whole Austro-Hungarian Empire. And, none of the historians are going to get it. I think maybe it was the Holy Roman Empire in those days, the last vestiges of it. And Kepler just worked on this data. He had this wonderful data, the best data there ever was, and he worked on it until he got to the point where he he made sense out of the mathematical interpretation of the data. And once he'd done that, he had a system, the first really modern system of astronomy, in which you could use very precise observations of the heavenly bodies and the positions, plus a very, very elegant mathematical set of equations. They're called Kepler's laws, and predict what the lights in the sky were going to do. I mean, it's a marvelous piece of work, and the first real scientific, full scientific work that linked the theories of the intellect with the observations of the senses.
Okay, and by this link you mean that there's a theory which involves certain mathematical assumptions and their observations and the ability to make predictions based on all those. Okay. It turns out we only have, believe it or not, a little over 3 minutes left.
Good Lord.
Why did it take so long for this birth to finally occur? I mean, you're talking about 420 years from the very beginnings in astronomy until the latest, the 1960 date in your account for geology. But even if you forget that, even if you just take the first three sciences, the first four, you're still talking 300 years.
Right.
Why did it take so long?
The world is difficult. I mean, the world's really hard to understand. And I'll give you one real quick example. The most incredible difficulty in chemistry was getting pure substances so that you could do the experiments on them. Because the minute you try and do experiments on impure substances, you get all sorts of foul reactions. And in order to get pure substances, you have to have a theory about what the substances are. So your problem is darn near circular. You got to have a theory to get the substances pure, but you got to have the substances pure in order to get the data for your theory. So you've got to be working on both those problems at the same time. In biology, things are so complicated, it's unbelievably complicated, that you've got to be able somehow or other to separate out the different kinds of forces, whether they're chemical, biological, or physical, that are operating on living systems, and then you got to figure out what the different living systems are doing to each other. So in each of the three cases, what you're dealing with is a new subject that is incredibly complicated, and it's very different from the other subjects.
Okay, so it's not just a matter that people are being closed-minded, for example.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
It's just they didn't have the wherewithal to do it.
They didn't have the wherewithal to do it, and it's difficult to get new ideas. I mean, like I said, they tried to use Newton's ideas, brand-new, wonderful, shiny new Newtonian ideas that work wonderfully in science and physics. They tried to use them to make sense of the chemical world. Didn't work. They had to take the ideas out of mineralogy, for the most part. And the metallurgy to figure out how chemistry worked.
All right, I don't even know where to start. We got about 30 seconds here. What kind of final message would you like to leave for the listener about modern science and its nature?
Well, it is probably the most exciting intellectual adventure that we've got. I mean, poetry and art are wonderful, and music are certainly the equal of science. But I'd have to say that science is an incredible adventure. It takes people with a lot of creativity and a lot of spirit to do it. It's difficult, and most of the time you're wrong. And that's the thing you got to keep in mind. Most of the time you're wrong, but you keep trying because it's a really wonderful intellectual adventure.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're right. Talk to you later.
Yep, bye-bye. Talking today to George Gale, Professor of Philosophy at University of Missouri, Kansas City. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.